everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Substation podcast. This is a shorter episode, which we are calling a buzz bar, where we focus in on a specific topic or publication. And in this instance, it is the new publication from National Grid around the market reform necessary to meet net zero. So we're going to do effectively a page turn as a kind of first reaction to this document, which was out last week.
Yeah, it's going to be like an unboxing video for a National Grid report. I mean, to be fair, we've both already read it, but it'll be fun to read it together.
Yes. I agree.
The first page, the front cover, is it says net zero market reform, and there's a bloke riding a scooter with some swishy lines. Emma says he's not wearing enough high-vis.
I suppose before we dive in, should we give a little bit of context to this?
Oh, on the report, yeah, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, so it's part of, I think, isn't it part of Grid's RIIO-2 settlement? Like they said, Ofgem have said, you should probably take a bit more of a steering role in market design. And so this is part of them going, okay, we've been asked to do this by the regulator, and it's part of our ESO RIIO-2 requirement. And they're looking at, you know, not only what does the market look like in 30 years time in terms of what's physically connected and, you know, what assets need to be there in terms of flowing the power and managing the system, but also what should the market frameworks be that get those things built and operates them. And that's what I think this report is about.
And I suppose National Grid have done a lot of thinking in this space in the shorter term. So obviously they think quite actively about what different balancing services should look like and, you know, how that should interact with markets kind of out to 2025, etc. But I suppose this is the first time, or this work stream is the first time that they've done a real market design piece in the longer term. And there's obviously other longer term stuff that they do. So notably things like the future energy scenarios publications, which consider what capacity will look like out to 2050 and, you know, the 10-year statement, that kind of thing. This is the first time they've really taken a role in designing market design, basically.
Yeah, which has been settled for a very long time. So, like, you know, nobody's really opened the hood on market design for like nearly 20 years.
Debatable. Yeah, I guess the market that we have, the wholesale market that we have in place.
That's what I think they're talking about here.
The other piece of context as well is the ongoing consultation from BEIS and Ofgem, which is around the future role of National Grid more generally, so the future system operator, which broadly sees a bigger role for National Grid or for a system operator at the heart to kind of drive some of these questions. So this is kind of National Grid kind of making a start and starting to play into some of that bigger role.
Because it'll be the independent system operator that has that the role here about market design and also like code governance. Yeah, they've also noted here it's different from other market reform projects they've undertaken with the longer term process out to 2035 and 2050. So that, yeah, that's...
And I think what's good about, I guess, National Grid doing it as well is it considers the role of system operation first and puts, which I think previous market reform programs maybe didn't. They were more kind of market based.
Yeah, I think there's, we'll probably get onto it, but there's a really good breakdown of what they think the market's for. Mm. So on page 6, we've got the overview of what they've done and what they plan to do.
Mm-hmm.
So phase one is the scoping and the stakeholder landscape. So that's
which you've already had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was about what is it they were supposed to be looking at? What's the high level analysis? Are there any case studies? This report is the phase two report, isn't it?
Mm.
So this is both the case for change mm-hmm. and possible solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got here, they've done some modelling, so that they've operated the hourly dynamic dispatch model, they've got their FES models, they've got and that's basically said, okay, you know, the market's going to be dominated by these technologies,
mm-hmm.
looks like this, the effects on prices will be that. And then they've done this identify solutions bit, which is like, yeah, which is what this report is all about. So it's basically saying, okay, given that we've got, you know, this much offshore wind, and then that means the price will be this level, what do we have for the objectives? What might work? What needs to be done? And then the next phase, which is scheduled for April 2022, is assessing the options that they're going to describe here, putting those together as packages, and then presenting some recommendations and a high-level roadmap for how that might look.
And I suppose at a high level, well, we'll get into the case for change now. I don't want to prejudge the paper.
So the case for change, this is the next section. What are they saying? So I think this is the bit that I was saying, you know, what needs to change? There's a handy Venn diagram.
The Venn diagram.
So investment is one part of the Venn diagram. There's making sure that the system can manage dramatic energy imbalances with flexible and firm technologies across both supply and demand. And then incentivizing assets to locate and dispatch so they minimize whole system costs.
Well, it's interesting because whenever I think of kind of the market design challenge historically, I always think of the trilemma, which is, I suppose, the maybe a bit simpler way of thinking about it, which is decarbonisation, security of supply, and affordability. Whereas here it's about, investment, firm capacity, flexible capacity as one, so I guess capacity delivering overall, and then the kind of location and dispatch point is about more, I suppose, system operation, locational specific stuff.
This is kind of like a point after the after the trilemma, though, isn't it? Because the trilemma is like, okay, we either have to have a clean system, a stable system, stable and secure system, or a cheap system. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is basically, okay, we need to have a clean system.
Mm-hmm.
Priority, it needs to be stable and secure, and we need to have it as cheaply as possible. But to do all of those things, to do those things, we now have another challenge, which is to invest at the scale and pace needed to deliver that by 2050. That's also going to mean, you know, if we do that, the system will experience dramatic energy imbalances. So that's like the wind, you know, if we have 40 gigawatts of wind, a 10% change in the wind load factor within the day is a 10 gigawatt swing, which is a big swing that might need to be coped with.
Mm-hmm.
And then if all of that is off in Scotland and the demand is still down in London, that's going to be expensive to shift around.
So they pretty much, I guess, they take the trilemma as given, and then these are the challenges flowing on from that. So I suppose the next section is really how much capacity we need. So, and, you know, I think on the one hand, obviously, that's a much greater volume of low carbon or zero carbon capacity. But as you mentioned, you know, to manage those inherent swings and the intermittency associated with low carbon generation, but also with heat and electrification, we need overall also more capacity than we have now. So it's almost those two kind of compounding factors and layering in things like security of supply. And, you know, it's a huge investment need that we have looking ahead.
Yeah, there's this chart on page 9, which has got the capacity changes over time, retirements and build, and you can see all the way out to 2050 in their leading the way scenario, there is the investment in multiple gigawatts each year of new intermittent low carbon generation.
The other kind of challenge underlying the investment challenge is this idea of cannibalization. So the idea that, you know, the more zero carbon, low carbon, and or subsidized generation that we have in the system, the lower the imbalance price, and therefore sort of the lower the capture price for low carbon generation and also all generation. And that's sort of a key thing I think we're all trying to get our heads around when it comes to things like market design.
So something we've never seen in a FES document is the price of power in under their scenario. So this is really exciting on page 10. I know that they've only done it for one of these. So for 2030, 2035, 2040, they've done the hourly thing. But they've got three scenarios and the baseload wholesale prices. So the baseload wholesale price in leading the way by 2030 is down below £25 a megawatt hour, and then does fluctuate back up to over £35. But that's just so low. I mean, yes, admittedly, right now we're in a crazy gas price world, but even in a relatively normal gas price world, a annual baseload price below £25 a megawatt hour must basically mean the gas is not running. And then they say that the offshore wind capture price is between £10 to £25 a megawatt hour, well below their actual operating costs.
Yeah. So I suppose, yeah, the baseload wholesale price, that just reflects kind of the generic price.
Yeah.
Whereas in practice, specific generators, particularly ones who, you know, have correlate with high renewables, will capture lower prices than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is quite an exciting chart for FES watchers, I suppose.
And how does it compare to your own modelling?
It correlates pretty well, actually, because the decline out to 2030, when you've got the... Because if you're building out to the 40 gigawatt offshore wind target, which happens in 2030, you're kind of over-investing before the demand arrives, because eventually you do expect electric vehicles, underlying demand, heat pumps, and hydrogen electrolysis demand to kind of pick up, but only, you know, out towards the end of the horizon. So if all that offshore wind comes on in the 2030s, you're over-investing, the power price should fall. And that first bit is definitely there in this chart. And then we see prices being kind of flattish after that, because even though demand is rising, you're just adding on renewable plant, which has a low marginal cost, and falling deployment costs over time through learning rates. So yeah, these look realistic to me.
And I suppose also interesting about this report on the next slide, which I've never seen National Grid do either, is look at the levels being paid out under the Contract for Difference. So, you know, the main subsidy, or the main renewable subsidy that we have in GB, I think we've mentioned it in previous podcasts, that gives, you know, a firm-ish price to renewable assets. But obviously to do that, we need a certain amount of money that's paid out to those assets. And this interestingly forecasts how much money we might be paying in subsidies kind of alongside the wholesale price.
And the support price under the CFD is the difference between the wholesale market price at the day ahead reference and the strike price agreed with the asset. So if the offshore wind farms agrees to be paid £30 a megawatt hour and the wholesale power price is £25 a megawatt hour, they'll get paid £5 a megawatt hour. So that's what this cost is. And they're saying that, okay, that CFD support cost to make those generators whole. So I presume then in the modelling, they've just said that the generators must make a certain amount of money, therefore there must be a subsidy to make it up. They're saying that, yeah, that difference between the power price, so if the offshore wind farm is earning £10 a megawatt hour and the whatever their strike price is, it's basically meaning that the cost of that support is going up to, it looks like somewhere in the region of 10-ish billion pounds a year. And then by 2030, with ranging kind of like between, what's that, about 7.5 and 22 billion pounds out in the 2040s.
And I think what's interesting about FES and also this report is they only really model or can model things that already exist. So they can't create new policies or, you know, assume what they'll look like, which is what the next section is then talking about. You know, there's a lot of talk about things like hydrogen, things about carbon capture, use and storage, long duration storage, all of these new things that we arguably need investment in to some degree, but we don't know what that looks like. We don't know what the support mechanism, if at all, would look like. So I guess they haven't been able to model the impact of those.
So that's kind of like, I think that makes the investment challenge is clear. We've, that, you know, or at least I feel like I've talked to death the idea of price cannibalization, and that, you know, capture prices fall for renewable plants. So they need some certainty in their investment decisions to bring forward new capacity at the cheapest possible price for consumers.
So the next section is then about what they call energy imbalances. And by that, they mean, I suppose, any fluctuation, deviation, intermittency of supply and demand that could be supply driven, so, you know, inherent intermittency of low carbon, but also demand driven as demand becomes more variable in future.
And also from the continent as well, so it doesn't have to just be
through interconnection.
Yeah, through interconnection. Yeah. And of course it's a range of timescales. So they've got the, you know, you can have the you can have the extremely short term kind of inertia, although I don't think they're not talking about this in this report, but I guess maybe that feeds in, maybe it feeds in later, but I get the feeling they're talking about like the intraday, you know, deviation from forecast wind speeds to, oh no, the wind hasn't blown for a week and isn't going to blow for the next couple of days. Seasonal issues. Good use of a low duration curve to show the amount of the periods when there will be kind of excess and under delivery from renewables. So there's lots of periods because the chart is heavy on the kind of zero side. Yeah, page 15, excess demand. There's a duration curve on the left-hand side showing that, you know, for lots of periods of the year. So I think these are the hours of the year along the x-axis. And the amount of excess generation or demand. So on the bottom, where there's a negative number, you've got more generation than the load, and on the right hand of the top side you've got more demand than load from renewables, so you'd have to make it up from interconnectors or base, you know, another form of power like nuclear or BECCS or something.
And I guess that's interesting, isn't it, because historically we thought about capacity adequacy issues in terms of not having enough capacity, but actually increasingly in the future it's about too much generation on the system, and how do we manage that?
Yeah, I wonder if we'll have like discussions around demand adequacy. How do we soak up all of that power? Which again, interconnectors are great. Hydrogen might be one of the things. Storage of various types. But yeah, so the low duration curve is clearly showing it goes from light blue to light green. Light blue is 2025, light green is 2015. You can see as it goes on the left-hand side, you can see it gets further and further down the y-axis, indicating that more hours of the year are oversupplied by 2050. In fact, 90% of the hours of the year are oversupplied by 2050, whereas it's about 4,500 hours in 2025. I do like a good low duration curve chart. There's another one. The capacity required. Okay, so increasing amounts of capacity are needed, but this capacity is not necessarily going to run an awful lot. There's lots of firm capacity is needed to manage these periods of either excess demand or potentially long duration shortfalls. So presumably if the power price is falling, how are they going to be remunerated?
Large number of capacity running for fewer hours.
Yeah, which on chart 18, they've got the fewer hours. So they can show that for that, you know, that firm and flexible kit in 2025 is running between 25 and 30% of the time. And we've got roughly, 45-ish gigawatts of it. But by 2050, there's somewhere between 50 gigawatts and 80 gigawatts of firm capacity, but its average load factors is below 5%.
And that would be a real driver for something like a capacity market, where you're saying, right, we know you're not going to run very much in the wholesale market, so you're not going to be able to capture many wholesale revenues, so we'll give you this alternative payment just to keep you there effectively. Yeah,
exactly. Next chart, 19, is showing the amount of excess generation with electrolysis, so you're seeing how much the hydrogen can soak up that additional electricity.
So, yeah, the next slide is really interesting and something that I think previous market reforms haven't really considered, which is the impact of location. So they call it the location challenge. So this is the idea that, you know, we don't have we have a single electricity market across all of GB, but in practice, not all bits of the network are created equal. And in practice, you know, not all energy can flow from one end to the other. And we have, as a result of that, thermal constraints. And constraint costs, which typically at the moment are managed in the balancing mechanism by turning a generator down in one part of the country and another generator up to kind of compensate and replace that energy. Those constraint costs have been growing steadily And are forecast on side 21 to continue to grow in the 2020s up to, so they say it's around £0.5 billion now, and they could rise to almost £2.5 billion per year, depending on the scenario. So that's in the leading the way scenario, which is the greenest scenario.
This is all of their constraints. I think this is under the NOAA optimal reinforcement pathway, but I'd say that this correlates with what I've seen when we've done projects forecasting constraints over certain boundaries. So this very clearly looks like it, or to me, looks like it's quite clearly correlated with a particular boundary, the B6 Scottish to English border boundary, because it starts dipping in 2029, the cost, which is when the eastern bootstraps should be coming online.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, that forecast of increasing constraint costs, one potential solution to that would be to have a more locational market. That could be a zonal market, a nodal market, where instead of having a single price zone where everybody's free to trade with everybody else, you divvy up the market in some way so that those locational signals are baked in effectively to the market design.
Yeah, because at the moment, they're the only signal, well, meaty signal anyway, is the Shinuos, which is a cost you pay every year to remain connected to the system. So it's supposed to incentivize generators to locate in the right location. Yeah.
That's illustrated on slide 23.
Yes.
And it's showing, yeah, the variations between different locations. So up in Scotland, where there's less demand, higher generation, those prices are higher, those costs are higher, and the costs slash benefits costs are lower slash benefits are higher in places like London and the south.
Yeah, and this is showing not only the spread between the zones. So you've got central London on the bottom being the one where they pay you the most, and North Scotland the one where you have to pay the most, but also that the charges change quite dramatically year to year, especially in Northern Scotland, because single generators coming in or out can have a very big effect. So there's a big dip in 2016-17 in Scotland when Kirkenzie, is it Kirkenzie or Longannet or something, one of the big generators leaves. You can also see the same thing in, so we've done this, we looked at the effects of when generators are left on Chinewas, and you can see the same thing happening in South Wales when Pembroke connects and when Aberfour leaves. So yeah, that's one of the big changes.
And I guess on the one hand, we want there to be, well, an economist would say we want efficient locational signals that send the right signals to people to locate where their assets are and also generate in the right areas. But on the other hand, investors would say, you know, hey, that completely undermines my investment case. Generators are built for 10, 15 plus years. So is it fair to be pulling the rug out of beneath us just for the sake of efficient market design?
Yeah. And there's a big box on the side that says this is inflates the cost of capital, or may inflate the cost of capital, which is, yeah, I mean, I would argue that that's true, because any risk you put into the investment does do that, because if there were no risk, then people would always put, you know, it would be a simple investment decision, wouldn't it? Can't take all the risk away, obviously. I think this is going to be a key point when we get to the bit at the end looking at the possible solutions in terms of how do you reflect that locational charge, and do you reflect it in the investment decision or the operational decision as well? Okay, so they've got some key challenges and overlaps. So I think this is where they're looking at the investment space, and are there any overlaps on some of the key things they've mentioned? So noting that supporting first-of-a-kind technologies overlaps quite a lot with the flexible technology bracket. And then without flexibility, that worsens price cannibalization. So those two link there.
So then the next section is setting out some assessment criteria that are used to evaluate potential market reforms. So here, this kind of refers back to some of the trilemma elements as well, doesn't it? So the first is decarbonization, which obviously everyone knows is key. We've got certain carbon targets for the energy market and the industry more and the society more generally. Security of supply, again, at its simplest, keeping the lights on. So that can be both, you know, ensuring there's adequate capacity, but also that it's the right kind of capacity, that it's firm, that it's flexible. Value for money is around the affordability point. So ultimately, customers are paying for everything. So we want this to be done in an efficient way. Investor confidence, as we've kind of mentioned earlier, you know, ultimately, we need people to invest in these, in this kit and this capacity. And we want, again, that to be done in an appropriate way. We want the cost of capital to be reasonable and not sort of unfairly inflated through different interventions. Deliverability. So, well, as it says in the tin, you know, the interventions should be deliverable in such a way that we can design them, introduce them, implement them in time to get things moving and ahead of net zero. Whole system is another kind of key term you hear quite a lot used in the industry. So this idea that, you know, it's not just about the transmission system anymore. It's not just about National Grid's old turf. It needs to be thinking end to end, sort of transmission to distribution and demand. Consumer fairness. So I suppose slightly different to overall value for money or affordability. It's the idea that the cost should be fairly shared. And I think fairness can be a bit of a tricky term to define. Competition, you know, competition everywhere is a principle that we embrace here in Britain and in the energy market. So we want generally to do things through competitive means, using markets, etc., using prices where possible. And adaptability, which is the idea that market design should be able to adapt to changes to technology or circumstances. You know, we obviously know there's a lot of unknown, well, there's a lot of known unknowns, there's probably a lot of unknown unknowns, and we need to be able to be adaptable in light of those, and the market needs to be able to be adaptable too.
I still quite like Ofgem's definition of fairness from the TCR, which is, you know, you should only be exposed to costs that you can reasonably manage. So if, you know, if there's no chance that you can affect how the cost comes out by changing your behaviour, then everybody should kind of, you know, it should be as fair as possible, as in flat as possible, and shouldn't encourage you to do anything and shouldn't distort your behaviour. Because I think it's all about how you can respond, if you can respond. How and if, there you go. I think we should go straight to this. So we're on slide 34.
So we skipped ahead a little bit.
Yeah, because we got too bogged down. And they've split out the kind of various elements of market design into five kind of key areas and put them against those criteria that we just talked about. And then they've scored them on a positive, neutral, negative, no clear thing. And there's a more detailed version in the appendix. So the first criteria is low carbon central planning. So this is kind of like, how do you deliver that 80 gigawatt target of offshore wind by 2050 or whatever? How do you decide to get there? Capacity adequacy. How do we make sure the system is secure and stable? Flexibility. How do we make sure it can respond to the signals and the physical characteristics of the system? Location, how does it cope with those constraints? And then dispatch, how do we actually tell the system what to do? And then underneath that, it's broken down into even more areas. So we could have, in low carbon central planning, we could have like bespoke arrangements. So this is, I think I would characterize this as maybe like CFDs, RO kind of.
So contract for difference and renewable obligation.
Yeah. So
the kind of historical sort of renewable subsidies that we've had.
Where you say, we want to buy some solar, or we want to buy some offshore wind, or we want to buy some onshore wind. And then you go and run a competition for that, or an allocation mechanism for that.
Which in theory, in practice, that's what it is. It's kind of bespoke, targeted at certain technologies. They were kind of sold, or certainly the contract for difference was sold as the next one, the next design option, which is inter low carbon technology competition, where you just have a single pot of money, a single auction, and all the different technologies kind of fight it out amongst themselves effectively.
Yeah. And then the final option is like a broad investment mechanism where there's kind of equal treatment for everything that's low carbon, no matter how it gets its, you know, how it earns its revenue, whether or not it's a low carbon storage or low carbon baseload or low carbon flex, or low carbon intermittent, that they're all kind of, there is some form of arrangement for paying for it. Could be centralized, I think they said, or could have multiple counterparties. So this could be like, again, I guess it could be a certificate scheme, or it could be a CFD arrangement. So the one that scores, okay, so I'm just going to judge this based on how many greens it has. The more greens it has, the higher it scores. So the one that scores the highest here in their initial assessment is the bespoke arrangement, because it's very deliverable. Investors are happy with it. And it meets the decarbonisation goals. I guess the difference there is that the broad investment mechanism is apparently scores badly on deliverability. And the other two schemes have score well for competition and delivering competition, which I guess if you're going to have there might be some minutiae in that, because if you're going to have like a centrally planned broad investment mechanism, I guess it would probably be about as the same as a broad but bespoke arrangements, because essentially still, how do you decide how much to give out?
Yeah. And the broad investment mechanism, so that includes low carbon and capacity as well, doesn't it? So that's having a single,
yeah.
Isn't it called, what does Dieter Helm call it? The firm equivalent capacity?
Equivalent firm capacity.
So the options then for capacity adequacy, so that's providing overall sufficient levels of investment in capacity. So that the first is, again, similar to low carbon, the bespoke arrangements, where you're saying, okay, batteries get this, and, you know, hydrogen gets that, and, you know, sort of treating different assets differently. The next option is then what's called a traditional capacity market, so similar to what we have now, where there's effectively a generic-ish kind of capacity auction where all capacity is treated the same, kind of. You know, there's obviously caveats and nuances to that in the current scheme, but, you know, broadly that's what a capacity mechanism generally looks like. The next option then is similar to the low carbon option. There's a broad investment mechanism.
And technically it's the same option.
Yeah, sorry, the same option. And then the final option is sort of ditching any kind of special mechanism for capacity adequacy and relying on wholesale price signals only. So effectively reverting to the world that we had pre-electricity market reform in 2011, where we just had an energy-only market and that was the only signal for investment. So using your scoring criteria, so the traditional capacity market, so effectively what we have now, plus or minus some tweaks, scores the highest compared to the others. The wholesale price signals only scores the lowest, so having no specific mechanism and just thinking about wholesale prices and bearing in mind, you know, those challenges around cannibalization, that scores the lowest. So the next, do you want to talk about the next one? So flexibility?
Yeah, so then there's, in flexibility, there's four options. So short-term markets where you can stack things together, bespoke arrangements, which would be, so your short-term markets with stacking is where, for example, the balancing mechanism store and FFR, where you can have like day-ahead auctions and you're allowed to like stack them all together. So that's kind of like the current system. Bespoke arrangements is where you have longer term agreements, which could reflect either the maturity of the product or the technology. So that'd be, I guess, a bit more like the Pathfinders or EFR, Enhanced Frequency Response, yeah. Long-term flexibility contracts, which is a bit like the short-term one, where you say, okay, if you're available, but we're going to give them for a bit longer, so, you know, years instead of days.
Mm-hmm.
Which gives investors a bit more confidence. And then some form of joint procurement signal with the firm capacity. So this has been discussed before, is where you You can adjust the amount of capacity you're awarded based on the kind of flexibility you can provide. So maybe in the future, someone who's signing up for a 15-year capacity agreement, but also promises to deliver dynamic containment, store, and the balancing mechanism together has a multiplier on their capacity that they win. So technically, the battery might be derated by 15%. It's a 100-megawatt battery, it's derated 15% because of its duration, but then there's maybe a multiplier for providing dynamic containment of about 50%. So actually it goes up to 30 megawatts, and that's how much they get paid for clearing under the capacity market. You don't need to buy quite so much of the other stuff because you're buying the premium DC as well as the capacity adequacy at the same time. Going by our patented system, I think. Oh no, bespoke arrangements gets three, or joint capacity, which bespoke arrangements, this is more of a change back to the world where you've got, enhanced frequency response, just batteries. Here's a battery contract, here's a gas peaker contract.
Which, I mean, arguably, I've certainly heard some commentators about some of National Grid's products. So, thinking about dynamic containment, for example, the way they're designed is such that only certain technologies can provide them anyway. So it's not too different, I guess, in that sense. So then the next category of options is the hot topic of locational pricing. So here, there's sort of three high-level options. So the first, where we retain a single national wholesale market, so anyone can trade with anyone within GB and they're not constrained by physical constraints of any kind. The next option then is to sort of subdivide Great Britain into specific zones. So that could just be two zones, it could be three, number range of different options there.
There's currently 27 zones for transmission charging
Nice.
for
So yeah, you'd
generators.
probably do it along either those lines or along thermal constraints, would be the other general way. And maybe that is something that would change year on year, or every 5 years or something like that as the system changes. And then the kind of more extreme option is nodal pricing, where it's really the most granular you could go, in terms of designing a market. So instead of having a single price zone, you kind of go down to nodes.
It would probably be every point of connection, either for, I mean, if you want to go to the nth degree, it would be like every point of connection. But I think if we're talking about the transmission system, it would be the either points of connection on the main integrated transmission system where for example, two lines meet each other, or where a generator connects, or where a load connects onto the system. So yeah, they're called grid supply points for where a load connects. Generators could also be a single node, but you can also have multiple generators connected to the same entry point. So
And I guess I suppose at a high level, on the one hand, having a single zone is great for market liquidity. So, the amount of people that you can trade with is maximized when you're not subdividing the market. But I suppose it's less good then for these locational signals we've been talking about. And then the other extreme, the nodal pricing, then there's a real question about, is there sufficient liquidity? Are there sufficient parties to trade with? If you are really, dividing up the market in very, very granular ways. So looking at the scoring, in this case, the status quo certainly wins. It gets the most greens, a couple of oranges. And the nodal wholesale market seems to score the least good or the worst, with a couple of negatives in terms of investor confidence and also deliverability. Which, is typically what you'd hear, that creating these zones or creating these nodes and then sort of how they might change over time would A, be very difficult, and B, be very challenging for people to invest off the back of. It would make the market more complicated and that sort of thing.
And deliverability is the other key one. Not fails, it scored badly on. I'm surprised it's done so well in competition as well. But again, there are probably, so for example, if I'm the only generator connected to a certain node and it's maybe behind a constraint, who am I trading with? But you can probably, there are ways of overcoming that through like financial transmission rights and contracts for difference and stuff like that. So yeah, maybe that's why it's scored yellow. And the final one is whether or not there is the current market arrangements where there's bilateral self-dispatch. So generators and consumers choose when to operate their equipment. based on deals they do with each other through either bilateral agreements directly or across markets. And then the other one is central dispatch, where parties would signal either their availability or intent to do something and the price for which they want to do something, and it would be the role of the central party to dispatch them. So that would be like going back to the pool arrangements before 2001.
I have heard about all markets being described as central dispatch ultimately, but the question is, where are you drawing that line and how late in the day are you drawing that line? And then there's also another question about sort of price formation. So are you centrally determining a price through some sort of algorithm or black box, or are you expecting most prices to be the result of bilateral trades, auctions, that kind of thing?
Yeah. So the great advantage of your bilateral self-dispatch market is that you can go and find certainty out in the market before timescales in any sort of central market you would know about. So you could trade theoretically, in a PPA you can trade all your generation away for like the entire life of the project and have a reasonable amount of certainty on the income that you'll get from it. Whereas in this traditional central dispatch market, you really only know what you're going to be doing maybe a couple of hours before. You can create some contracts around that to give yourself certainty.
The main benefit of having a central market, I'm going to play the opposing view, but the main benefit of a central market is that you have a single central price. So there is a single reference price that can be, in theory, hedged, and people can wrap contracts around. So currently we have that in the form of the day ahead price, but in a central dispatch market, you could have that as sort of a real time price, and you could allow people to put contracts around that real time price.
That one scores, well, okay, so I guess they both got quite good scores, which I think reflects that, you know, they're really quite similar. There's not that much difference in terms of them, but oh wow, I'm surprised it didn't score green on value for money for bilateral self dispatch, because some people do quite well in bilateral self dispatch. And
well, I mean, that's the whole principle, like why we moved our market from central dispatch in the pool to what we have now, bilateral, was the principle that competition and competitive freedom would ultimately lower costs. That was key.
Yeah.
You know, in that decision. So it's interesting now that value for money isn't scoring higher, for sure.
But the real difference is that central dispatch scores badly on deliverability. So presumably whatever, it's a fundamental change to the very structure, like the base structure of the market, I think, which would cause a lot of change. I think that's also reflected in a lot of the other things. So things like they've said that you, or at least they assume, that you wouldn't have a nodal wholesale market without central dispatch and co-optimization, which you could, I think, but I guess it would make it much more complicated to not have it. And then the final one that you should definitely look at if you're reading this is slide 37. These are the different options that they're going to assess. The one I'm obviously most interested in is option Z, which is the nodal wholesale market with a central dispatch. And probably, I mean, a broad investment mechanism, it would be interesting to see what that looks like.
Yeah, I think that's my favourite combo as well. I love a central dispatch market. I think, you know, with a greater role for National Grid and for system services, it just makes sense. I mean, the economist in me would like more locational pricing, so hey, why not nodal? And yeah, I've always quite liked what I always call the Dieter Helm model, but this idea that you could have a single mechanism that co-optimizes or co-procures both, you know, firm capacity and low carbon capacity at the same time, again, just feels efficient to me.
I think in nodal wholesale markets, it's again, be careful what you wish for. If you think tenuous is swingy and difficult to forecast,
Yeah. It'll
be doubly so for nodal wholesale markets, no matter what you say, because, I mean, a lot of the swinginess in tenuous comes from the fundamental things that will drive the nodal wholesale market. And then a lot of the unpredictability in Chinoas comes from the fact the rules changes all the time. And that's not going to be any different in the nodal wholesale market. People will be fiddling with the rules all the time. So it's great news for consultants.
And market design geeks market like design ourselves. Geeks,
yeah.
So they're the kind of, they're the packages. So the next steps then, so for this project, this is phase two, this is kind of the long list of options. So they're considering, I guess, in a bit more detail about how the different combinations will work in practice and assess sort of second order priority elements and how they could impact the design going forward. And presumably off the back of this, there'll be some sort of formal consultation.
Then there'll be more stakeholder meetings and they'll do their design options. And so that, I mean, I've been involved in some of these stakeholder meetings and roundtables and stuff. So yeah, they've definitely been doing them. I guess the next stage is probably the most interesting stage because it'll have some modeling around those options and we'll have this roadmap. I have a small concern on a regulatory governance side that this should really be Bayes.
Somebody has to do it though, Tom.
Right, but if
I think that this has been an ongoing problem though in the industry, right, where somebody says this should be government, no, this should be Ofgem. If Ofgem does it, then people, you know, I think as long as somebody's doing it.
But if nothing happens, but how can, I mean, this is going to require legislative change.
Sure, but it requires the thinking up front, right? And maybe National Grid are in a better position to do that than Bayes currently. And I think also with the, you know, future system operator, greater role for National Grid, maybe it will be their role in future. So I'm just glad it's being done. Final thoughts?
Super excited. Confirms lots of things we've been saying for a while. Can't wait for the second quarter of 2022.
When all should be revealed.
When all should be revealed.
Future market design. Cool. Okay. Let's leave it there. This was a long, short episode, but
sorry.